This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. During the first major engagement of the Civil War, America suffered more casualties than ever before. The Battle of First Manassas set the stage for the bloody years ahead. During the next 4 years, about 620,000 Americans would lose their lives. The North prevailed, but the Union victory was never a foregone conclusion. UNC professor Joseph Glatthar says Abraham Lincoln may have been a great political leader, but he didn't know much about military strategy. His missteps prolonged the Civil War and almost caused the resignation of one of the Union's great generals. Joseph Glatthar is Stevenson Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also the author of General Lee's Army, From Victory to Defeat. As part of our series, North Carolina Voices, the Civil War, Joseph Glatthar joins us in our studio to talk about the bloody campaigns and brutal narrative of the Civil War. Welcome, Joe. Good to have you here.
Good to be back here, Frank.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back on the show. We talked about your important contribution to literature and fiction in the past, but of course it's because of your work in actual history and nonfiction. This war was bloodier than anyone had foreseen. Is that true? I mean, was it not clear that this war would be as bloody and prolonged as it was when it started?
Very few people thought that it would be as sanguinary as it actually proved to be. Most individuals grossly underestimated what it would take to defeat the other side.
Who were the soldiers initially in the South? Who was fighting this war? The soldiers themselves.
The soldiers who, in 1861, of course, people rallied behind the flag in defense of their country, so large numbers of people turned out, mostly younger people. The early soldiers tended to be folks who were single, unattached, people who could uproot themselves and go into the army, and people who were eager for the adventure.
It was, of course, later on you start taking husbands away and farmers, people who are operating the farms, and that's when it starts getting unsustainable.
That's right. In the second year, you begin to see actually a majority of the soldiers who are married. And, of course, the married soldiers are ones who can't really go initially, and it's only when it becomes apparent that the war is going to be long and the Confederacy is going to conscript that the married soldiers start coming out in large numbers.
So let's talk a little bit about the Union plans throughout this war, how they changed and how they began. There was something early on called the Anaconda Plan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Winfield Scott was the commanding general of the Union forces. And Scott came up with what's been called the Anaconda Plan. That was the derisive name that newspaper men gave to Scott's concept. But Scott's concept actually made good sense. What Scott wanted to do was impose a blockade and then seize various port cities by landing troops, seizing them by land, and then sending troops down the Mississippi River and gaining control so that you would sever the East from the West. And then as the war went on, you would probably have to send land troops in, oftentimes drawing supplies from various rivers that penetrated deep into the Confederacy. But what Scott didn't want to have happen was to have a massive bloodbath, because he was fearful that if large amounts of blood were shed and the Union defeated the Confederacy, then the Union would have to occupy the Confederacy for several decades. And that would be so prohibitively expensive and problematic that that might not be worth it. So he thought slowly pressuring the Confederacy without extensive violence and hopefully calmer heads would prevail and a negotiation would take place.
Kind of war of attrition and get them to give up. That didn't work out. And in fact, then the Battle of First Manassas proves to be the bloodiest ever in American history. No one is prepared for that. What effect did that have on the future of the war?
Well, of course, Lincoln succumbed to tremendous pressure from the media and others to march directly on the Confederate Army, which was positioned around Manassas, where a railroad junction was. And so the Union, of course, was defeated in the battle with huge, huge losses. And, of course, at that point, then a huge transformation takes place in the Union Army. Many individuals are starting to come to the conclusion that this is going to be very difficult to defeat the Confederacy, that the commanding general of that army, a guy named Irvin McDowell, was removed, and George B. McClellan was brought in and put in charge. And McClellan then began training the army. Lincoln pushed them forward And McDowell had complained that the troops were inexperienced, and Lincoln's response was, "It is true that your soldiers are green. So are the enemies. You're both green alike." In other words, neither side is prepared for this. But the problem is that it's much more difficult to fight on the offensive than on the defensive. And so the Union had a more difficult row to hoe.
And, of course, the objective for the Union is essentially to get the Confederacy to surrender. There's not really an occupation that's going to make this thing be over, right?
That's right. Remember, the Confederacy is three-quarters of a million square miles of territory, essentially Western Europe. So an occupation of that magnitude is simply ludicrous. What you've got to do is convince the Confederacy that life in the Union was better than life outside the Union.
So that makes it sound like that Anaconda Plan should have been pretty good. Why was it rejected?
There's too much pressure to advance. We have what we oftentimes refer to as a rage militaire. The war comes, people are fired up, they want action. And the Lincoln administration was being pressured to advance aggressively. And then, of course, once you begin to suffer heavy losses, then that element takes on a momentum of its own. Soldiers want revenge. Their egos are damaged. They've got to defeat the enemy, and so on and so forth.
So let's talk about some of the key figures in this war. Ulysses S. Grant ultimately becomes the guy in charge of the army after a lot of changes. Lincoln is having a hard time finding somebody to run his war. He finally finds Grant. Tell us about him.
Yeah. Ulysses S. Grant is a marvel because he graduates in the middle of his West Point class, and he's a very, very fine soldier in the Mexican War. If you read Grant's memoirs, you gain tremendous insight into Grant's character because he describes events as an observer, but it's as if he couldn't possibly have been injured. In other words, he's soaking up all sorts of detail, and what you realize is this is a guy who's really calm in crises. That's a tremendous attribute for a military leader. And so Grant ended up seeking a position on McClellan's staff. McClellan never even responded. But the locals, where Grant lived in Illinois, had him drilling troops. And since he knew how to drill troops, the next thing you know, he's a regimental commander. And quickly he rose up. He fought a peculiar battle at a place called Belmont, where his troops overran the Confederate camp. But then the discipline broke down. The soldiers started plundering. And then the Confederates regrouped and drove Grant off. So Grant learned a valuable lesson there. And then his next major campaign was Forts Henry and Donelson. And this is really significant in February 1862 because the Confederates in the West have a loose cordon defense. And what Forts Henry and Donelson did was it shattered that cordon. So when not only did Grant capture a Confederate army, but he broke the Confederate line so dramatically that the Confederacy had to fall all the way back into northern Mississippi, abandoning Nashville. They still held on to East Tennessee, but in effect, Kentucky and now almost all of Tennessee were in Union hands. So it was a huge victory, and that put Grant on the fast track.
You talked about his calm in battle. Did alcohol have anything to do with that? How about his reputation for drink?
There's evidence in the Grant papers that Grant drank, but there's no evidence that Grant drank during active campaigns.
Yeah.
That Grant was actually a very clear-headed thinker.
This was a part of the propaganda after the war, in a sense, painting him as a lush and corrupt.
Well, Grant had developed a drinking problem in the 1850s. He had been newly married, got assigned to California. He missed his wife terribly. And so he was bored, and he took up drinking and drank too much. He resigned his commission, and so he earned a reputation in the old army as a drunk. And so after Fort Donelson fell to Grant, Grant pushed on towards Nashville, and the communications from Grant's superior, Henry W. Halleck, to Grant were intercepted and weren't being delivered. And Halleck kept sending Grant messages and getting no response. So Halleck assumed that Grant was a drunk and even contacted the commanding general of the Union Army, George B. McClellan at that point, claiming that Grant's up to his old tricks again. And McClellan authorized Halleck to remove Grant. So Grant was placed under arrest. And Grant, when he was placed under arrest, had no idea what Halleck was talking about because, of course, he had received no messages from Halleck. Ultimately, the truth came out, and so Grant was immediately restored to his position.
Let's take a look at Robert E. Lee on the other side. Tell us about him.
Robert E. Lee was an excellent soldier in the old Army who had gained a fabulous reputation during the Mexican War. And in fact, in testimony in a court-martial, Winfield Scott described Robert E. Lee as the finest soldier in the U.S. Army. And that's under oath. And of course, he was a great hero in the Mexican War and then became superintendent of West Point and lieutenant colonel of the 2nd U.S. Cavalry. He had been promoted to the commander of the 2nd U.S. Cavalry shortly before he resigned his commission to go to Virginia. And of course, he was immediately assigned as the head of Virginia forces and then later a 4-star general in the Confederate Army. Lee's career stumbled initially because he was assigned to West Virginia and he was trying to, well, technically at that time it was Western Virginia, mm-hmm. and he was trying to coordinate 3 different columns, two of which were led by incompetence, and the Union forces won the battle. And the Confederacy reacted as if Lee had lost some monumental fight and his reputation plummeted. Eventually, Davis had to move him from the fishbowl of Richmond, Virginia, and send him down to South Carolina, where he oversaw South Carolina, Florida, and Georgia defenses.
But I'm going to leave it right there. We're going to take a break and come back and continue this conversation on the state of things today with Civil War UNC Professor Joseph Glattar. Just ahead, talk about the motivations that drove the Civil War. That's on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the bloody campaigns of the Civil War with UNC History Professor Joseph Glattar. We're talking about Robert E. Lee and his reputation just before the break.
When we broke, I was talking about how Lee had just been brought back for the 1862 campaign to serve as Davis's military advisor. And in the Battle of Seven Pines, Joseph E. Johnston was wounded, and so Davis tapped Lee temporarily to take over that Army command. And of course, Lee performed marvels there. He regrouped, streamlined administration, and eventually launched a successful attack that drove the Union forces 20 miles back. And that was the first victory of Lee. And then, of course, within a couple of months, Lee was back up in Maryland. So he literally transformed the war in Virginia. It's a really extraordinary achievement.
Talk about the difference in planning for the war in the Confederacy and the Union. Who was doing the planning, the master strategic planning for the Confederacy?
Jefferson Davis was a West Point graduate, a regular Army officer, former Secretary of War and Confederate president. And he formulated the Confederate strategy, which essentially was this. What Davis wanted his military commanders to do is to deliver powerful blows against Union invaders as close to the border as possible because he didn't want Confederate citizens to be overrun. That would result in limited supplies, and also soldiers would be encouraged to desert to look after their loved ones. And so that was Davis's plan. And the object was to deliver really powerful blows to discourage the Union from continuing to invade the Confederacy. From the Union standpoint, Abraham Lincoln largely devised the strategy. Initially, there was a lapse because Lincoln was trying to work his way up to speed, and he did have Winfield Scott, who was very smart. When McClellan came in, McClellan oversaw the military aspects of the war, but McClellan couldn't get people to cooperate, people to move in unison. And it wasn't really until Abraham Lincoln appointed Ulysses S. Grant as the commanding general that the Union forces moved in unison. That is, everyone advanced on a campaign at roughly the same time.
And there was talk about Lincoln's missteps in this war. You suggest that he was not a very good strategist, maybe not the guy to have in charge of this war.
Well, I think Lincoln's good. I think he's an excellent commander-in-chief, but some people have claimed he was a military genius, and that's simply wrong. To expect that kind of achievement out of an individual with virtually no military experience is asking far too much. The problem Lincoln had was he didn't have very good advisors around him, and he really needed that. So, for example, in 1864, he authorized Nathaniel P. Banks to launch a campaign up the Red River, and Banks had to draw troops from Sherman's army that was going to advance towards Atlanta. Well, Banks suffered a defeat. The troops never got back. 2 weeks before the campaign, Sherman had to come up with a new operational strategy for the campaign. Even if the campaign up the Red River was successful, it would not have significantly advanced the Union cause. It made no sense. The war was east of the Mississippi by that point. It wasn't west of the Mississippi River. And so the only place you were going to win the war was east of the river. And so to make a decision like that was foolish. And on other occasions, he blocked policies that would have shortened the war, in my opinion, or certainly he prevented certain campaigns, especially by Ulysses S. Grant, which would have, for example, closed the port of Mobile. That would have been a real asset for the Union if Mobile were closed, because in the late stage of the war, only Mobile and Wilmington were open ports.
And, of course, another of Grant's strategy that that Lincoln rejected was one that looked pretty similar to Sherman's campaign, only it would have taken place right here in North Carolina.
That's right. Grant proposed that about a 60,000-man strike force advance from southern Virginia and penetrate into North Carolina, living off the land, destroying the railroads and bridges and anything of military value in North Carolina, and then coming out at Wilmington. Had Grant executed this, Lee could not have held on to Richmond because he couldn't have gotten the resources necessary to protect Richmond, and Richmond manufacturing couldn't have gotten the raw materials to manufacture. So Lee would have had to fall back. And of course, once Lee abandons Richmond, that's the place where all his ammunition is manufactured. And so the Confederacy would have been in really, really bad shape. It's quite an ingenious idea on Grant's part. But by that stage, Lincoln, Stanton, and the commanding general, Henry W. Halleck, were so fixated on the defeat of Lee's army. Lee's army had become so monumental in their minds that they could not envision any other way of defeating Lee's army than a head-on clash. And, of course, the head-on clash was disastrous. I don't know if you're aware, but the last 12 months of the war, Lee's army inflicted 127,000 casualties on the Union forces.
And how many
a product of that head-on clash?
Compared to how many for his forces?
Oh, right. Lee would have suffered. If you include those who surrendered at Appomattox, Lee would have suffered, far, far less, perhaps 75,000, 80,000.
So in a sense, the Lincoln and the Union were drinking the Kool-Aid, in a sense. The idea that this is a military head-to-head battle, the blood and glory, and not about attrition and diplomacy or any of those.
Well, I think they got frustrated with previous commanding generals who focused too much on cities and geographical points as opposed to the destruction of the enemy army. And what Grant and Sherman came to realize was that there are various ways of destroying an enemy army, and you don't have to bash them head-to-head on a battlefield to do that.
So let's talk a little bit more about some of the underlying causes of the war. You know, we still hear from time to time that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about, states' rights and all these other things. But you have some of the documents from the states declaring their reasons for separation, and they're pretty clear.
Yes. When I teach the class on the lectures on Civil War, I read from the secession documents. Let's see what the southern states were saying, what they wrote, how they justified what they did. So let me just read you a few. Here's Georgia. For the last 10 years, we have had numerous and serious causes of complaint against our non-slave-holding Confederate states with reference to the subject of African slavery. That's pretty blunt. Mississippi is even more blunt. I love this one. In the momentous step which our state has taken of dissolving its connection with the government of which we so long formed a part, it is but just that we should declare the prominent reasons which have induced our course. Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world. And then if we read Texas, after saying that Texas abandoned her national existence to leave the Union, it then went on to write She was received into the Confederacy, meaning the Union, with her own constitution, under the guarantee of the federal constitution and the compact of annexation that she should enjoy these blessings. She was received as a commonwealth holding, maintaining, and protecting the institution known as Negro slavery, the servitude of the African to the white race within her limits, a relation that had existed from the first settlement of her wilderness by the white race, and which her people intended should exist in all future time. Those indicate clearly that the southern states are seceding to protect slavery.
How influential were black soldiers and former slaves in the conduct of the Civil War itself?
Black soldiers and former slaves were a huge contributor to the Union victory. In fact, Abraham Lincoln felt that if you abandon black military service, you throw away the Union. You keep it and you preserve the Union. All told, 180,000 black soldiers served in the Union Army, and about 20,000 black sailors served in the Navy. In addition, you had tens of thousands of people who worked as teamsters, stevedores, and all sorts of other jobs. Those were tremendous, tremendous numbers. And, of course, the bulk of those were former slaves. So when the Confederacy went into war, it assumed that the slaves would be contributing to the Confederate war effort. Those former slaves were now removed from the Confederate labor supply. Furthermore, they were fighting to destroy the institution of slavery and, of course, defeat the Confederacy. So, as Lincoln said, it works doubly.
But Lincoln was slow to embrace the idea of colored troops, as they were called then.
Yes, Lincoln was a little slow, but he had to deal with the northern public and especially the border states. There's a tremendous amount of prejudice against African Americans in the northern states, and Lincoln needed to know that the border states were loyal. When various efforts to include or create black units arose, Lincoln tended to dismiss them or block them because he wanted to control the process very carefully. It wasn't until late spring, early summer that Lincoln came to the realization that the single largest untapped resource was blacks. And furthermore, Lincoln realized that if you do not destroy the institution of slavery and you restore the Union will be battling these same issues that it had been battling since 1818 in the Missouri crisis. And so it was imperative that the nation put the issue on the road to extinction, as Lincoln had said in his 1858 speech.
We talked about First Manassas being a bloody and a kind of a surprisingly so battle in the Civil War. What were some of the worst battles of the Civil War?
Well, Shiloh was April of 1862 was a shock because roughly 23,000 soldiers on both sides were killed, wounded, or captured. And, of course, this was four times the size of First Manassas, and people were really jolted. Later on, of course, you have the 7 days battle that Lee fights against McClellan, and there you have roughly 36,000 casualties on both sides. So quickly, the war turns into a huge, huge bloodbath. And then there are other major battles, almost 30,000 casualties at Chancellorsville, close to 50,000 at Gettysburg, and that's not. And then, of course, at Vicksburg, the casualties are lower, but Grant captures an entire army, so those are really significant. Another big battle was Chickamauga, and then, of course, the really vicious fighting that took place in what we refer to as the Overland Campaign, the campaign that began in May of 1864, in which Meade was confronting Robert E. Lee's army, and Grant was in the headquarters tent right next to Meade's. And so that Overland Campaign, the losses were staggering. I think in an eight-week period, Grant's army lost 70,000 men.
So these are dramatic battles. They certainly are having an impact on the psyches of the Confederacy and the Union. But did they have much strategic influence in the war?
Grant didn't want to turn it into a war of attrition, but that's ultimately what happened. That is, he was just grinding it out, and he was trying to get around Lee's flank, trying to get a position and force Lee to attack him, but he just couldn't do it. And so it turned into an attrition type of campaign, and that's why the blood loss was so staggering.
Psychologically, as the casualties mount, as we've seen this over and over again, and we're seeing it again in Iraq and Afghanistan, the American people expect to win quickly, and when they don't, they start to lose heart over the battle. Was that happening in the North, and how did Lincoln manage to maintain support for the war?
That's one of the marvels of Abraham Lincoln, and I think this is one of the reasons why he's such a great commander-in-chief. Lincoln keeps the North in the war effort. He convinces soldiers he's doing everything on in his power to aid them in crushing the rebellion, and he rallies the Northern people through his speeches, through his writings, and through his actions and policies. And he somehow manages to sustain that Northern support for the war. And it's truly extraordinary what Abraham Lincoln does in the face of absolutely astounding casualties.
What do you think is behind it, and how was he reelected?
What Lincoln is very good at doing is conveying to the Northern public just what this war was all about and why it was so significant. And Lincoln played it up in terms not just for the current generation, but for future generations. He reminded everyone that the United States of America was an experiment in democratic republicanism, and that if we allowed secession, you could not preserve a union. And as a result, and he kept reminding people that this is what separates the United States from every other country, and that your freedom is predicated on the survivability of the Union and the U.S. Constitution, and it's imperative for generations to come that they have these same advantages. So he's really good at communicating these sorts of things, and he resonates very effectively with the Northern people.
Given the task at hand, given what the task for and the object for the Confederacy and their resources, were they ever really close to winning the war?
The Confederacy could have won the war. In 1862, Lee's army was in Maryland, and Braxton Bragg's Confederate army had moved into Kentucky. There was some talk about Great Britain recognizing the Confederacy. So that was a critical moment, I think. And then the other critical moment was in the summer of 64, because the Union army had suffered staggering losses. It appeared that Grant was locked into siege at Petersburg and victory wasn't likely to come. From an outside viewpoint, Sherman had advanced near Atlanta, but it didn't look like Atlanta was going to fall. And of course, you had the presidential election coming up. And a lot of Republicans were dissatisfied with Lincoln because they felt like the war wasn't making great progress. And then around that time, Jubal Early launched a raid where he was stopped on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. Can you imagine what the ramifications would have been had Early penetrated Washington defenses and been in the city just for 4 or 5 hours? And, you know, they would have burned a number of government buildings, right. And the Northern people would have thought, at this stage of the war, we've lost over 250,000 lives, and have we really progressed very far towards victory? And that would have been a legitimate question to ask. But of course, Early was stopped.
Right.
Atlanta fell to Sherman, and Lincoln won the re-election.
Tell us about Sherman's march, because, again, this seemed to go against the prevailing strategy that we had to go head-to-head and defeat the army, and now Sherman, the idea of attrition, finally prevails.
Grant and Sherman came to the realization when they were dealing with affairs in the Mississippi Valley that the occupation of territory dissipated manpower strength and didn't really advance the cause. And they also witnessed the destructive capabilities and achievements of their forces, their soldiery. And so they began to harness this concept about launching raids where they would destroy the enemy's railroads and bridges and anything that could be used for military value, meanwhile living off the land, because, of course, the South is a very productive agricultural region. And so they tested it in Jackson, Mississippi, and of course, during the Vicksburg campaign in part. But then Sherman launched a campaign against Meridian, Mississippi, and that proved successful. And so it was Grant and Sherman's intention in 1864 to have Sherman break up the Confederate command that opposed him and then penetrate in the interior and launch this giant raid. So after Atlanta fell, Sherman eventually launched that raid heading towards Savannah. And in the course of that movement, he maneuvered his army so that the Confederacy wouldn't know where he was going. First, it looked like he could go to Macon, which was a munitions manufacturing city, or Savannah. Then he shifted between Savannah and Augusta. Augusta had the big gunpowder mills. Meanwhile, his troops were living off the land, wrecking railroads, doing other destruction, and consuming livestock, killing animals that the army couldn't take with it. And of course, this instilled tremendous fear in the civilian population. After Savannah fell, they waited until late January and then pushed on into South Carolina. And South Carolina really suffered because Sherman's soldiers believed it was the hotbed of secession. This is what the war was all about. As one soldier said, they sow the wind, they will reap the whirlwind. And so they went in there and literally destroyed vast, vast quantities of things, burned homes, burned towns. I mean, they probably burned most or all of about 24 towns or cities in South Carolina. And then when they came into North Carolina, soldiers eased up. The army made it clear to the soldiers that North Carolina had barely voted for secession, that it wasn't South Carolina. It didn't warrant that same level of destruction. Now, of course, the army still was at war until they wrecked railroads and things like that in North Carolina. But the level of wanton destruction eased dramatically.
My guest this hour, Joseph Glattar, professor of history at UNC. Just ahead, we're going to learn a little bit about Bennett Place in Durham and its important role in the Civil War and its aftermath. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking this hour about the battles and strategy of the Civil War with UNC history professor Joseph Glattar. Joining us now in the studio is John Guss. He's the site manager for Bennett Place State Historic Site in Durham. Welcome, John. Good to have you here.
Hey, glad to be here.
Tell us about Bennett Place and its importance in the Civil War and after.
Well, Bennett Place was a very little-known farm. It was virtually not known at that point in time in history. James and Nancy Bennett, small southern family, raising three kids there on the farm of roughly about 189 acres during the 1850s. And then, of course, when the war broke out, they had one of their sons, their oldest son, actually go off and serve in the Confederate Army the second year of the war. And then their daughter, who had married one of these well-known family names here in the Durham area, Duke, a man by the name of Robert Duke. He went off and served in the Confederate Army, but he was also lost during the war. Both these men died of disease during the course of the war, and then a younger son who stayed home, but he also died. So many soldiers and civilians died of disease in that point in time in history. So the Bennetts had virtually lost all of their family members, with the exception of their daughter, during the course of this war.
Of course, what makes the place famous is it is the site of the largest troop surrender in the Civil War, and it followed by several weeks the surrender at Appomattox. Tell us about that, what was going on there, who was there, and what happened.
Yeah, the activity at this point in time, it's April of 1865. You have the surrender at Appomattox Courthouse on April the 9th. You still have fighting here in this general area of the central part of North Carolina going on. Sherman has moved into downtown Raleigh, and General Johnson's army is retreating across through the central part of North Carolina over to Greensboro. And at that point in time, when General Johnson actually finds out that Lee has surrendered, he realizes that his options are virtually none as far as prolonging the war. So he sends a courier over to Sherman's army, which had advanced as far as Morrisville Station, and requested a meeting so that the two of them could discuss the termination of the war.
Virtually none, but Joe Glattar, there was some talk of continuing that war, even though Lee had surrendered, and it would be a kind of guerrilla war. Tell us about that kind of talk.
Yeah, the issue was raised by a number of individuals. Lee didn't embrace it because he felt like the Confederacy was defeated, the spring had arrived, it was imperative that his soldiers go home and plant crops and move on. He didn't think that the guerrilla war would be successful and it would simply extend the violence against the South. Johnston felt like he wasn't under duress. He wasn't boxed in. He wasn't trapped like Lee was at Appomattox Courthouse. And so Johnston felt like he had better room to maneuver as far as negotiations were concerned.
So he ends up negotiating with Sherman. They're there, and they're an awful lot of Confederate and Union troops there as well. Give us an idea of how many people were hanging around this little farm in Durham.
Well, this was actually very much a different setting than what happened at Appomattox. Most of your troops were there right there in the village of Appomattox Courthouse, whereas you have the Union Army of close to 90,000 troops at this point in time, Sherman's Army, and also the Expeditionary Force that had come up through Wilmington. You've got almost 90,000 troops camped out in downtown Raleigh, and you have somewhere in the neighborhood of 25,000 to 30,000 Confederates in Greensboro. So when these two generals set out on the morning of April 17th of 1865, you have roughly about 60 Confederate cavalry troopers that are accompanying General Johnston on the road of the old Hillsboro Road leading over toward Raleigh. And then you have General Sherman getting on a train from Raleigh to head over to Durham Station. And from that point, he takes or meets up with an escort of about 200 cavalry troopers. So you have roughly about 300 Confederate and Union soldiers right there in the immediate area of the Bennett Farm at this point in time.
Tens of thousands more, as you say, in Raleigh and elsewhere. And tell us about now the relationship between Johnston and Sherman. Sherman has just finished this horrendous march, as far as the Confederacy is concerned, and now they're meeting face-to-face.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point about their first meeting at Bennett Place or at the Bennett Farm. These men had both gone to West Point. They had fought across many of the same battlefields. They'd been on the same battlefield at Manassas, Virginia. They had also been out west in the Vicksburg campaigns and then fought against one another in the Atlanta campaigns until Joe Johnston's relieved of his command, and then he's reinstated at the very end of the war, and they fight the battles around Bentonville and Averysboro. So their roads are the same, but it was not until the Bennett Farm that they met there on April 17th of 1865 for the very first time. And their meeting was a very respectful meeting, their first initial contact, although their subordinate officers, General Wade Hampton, who was Johnston's cavalry commander, and General Judson Kilpatrick, there was no love lost between these men.
So now Johnston and Sherman get together, and the original armistice that they worked out would have worked out far better for the Confederacy and for the South. But tell us about, because something else very important was happening at the same time.
Well, at this point in time, you have the assassination of Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater on April 14th. He dies the morning of the 15th. And so just as Sherman had gotten on the train, or just before he was getting on the train in Raleigh to come over to Durham, he had received the telegram that the president had been assassinated, and so he was very much trying to keep that under wraps so that the mood would not have swung in a very violent situation over in Raleigh with his troops. And that message was not delivered or it was not revealed until he walked in the door of the Bennett farmhouse and sat down with General Johnston. And at that point, Johnston realized the bargaining opportunities were almost nil.
They did come up with an agreement. They sent it to Washington, and it was rejected. Tell us about that first agreement.
Prior to these surrenders taking place, President Lincoln had sat down in Virginia with his officers, Grant, Sherman, and Admiral Porter, and discussed the terms of putting an end to this war. And it was Sherman's understanding when he met at the Bennett Farm that Lincoln had wanted to bring the South back in as peaceably as possible and get this country back moving forward. However, with those negotiations, Sherman felt like he was trying to give more lenient terms to the South, providing more rights or rights to the citizens and restructuring the Southern governments. And it was not his place to do so. The politicians in Washington immediately rejected these terms and sent General Grant down to Raleigh to actually overtake or take over Sherman's command and deal with these negotiations or continue the war within 48 hours.
Now, the question was whether or not you could include some of these political planks or provisions in the armistice, including amnesty, but these were all rejected, certainly in the aftermath of the assassination. Any sense of how it might have gone had Lincoln not been assassinated?
We can only speculate. Obviously, there was still a lot of hostility in the South toward Abraham Lincoln. It was one of the reasons why the South finally made the move to secede. And so it would have continued to be a very rocky road for North and South to be able to get along peaceably after the actual fighting ceased.
But interesting to imagine what would have happened had there been less harsh terms imposed on the South if Lincoln had gotten his way and tried to reconcile rather than punish the South. Wonder if things would have been different. Joe Glather, let's talk a little bit. I want to talk more about this, the possibility of a guerrilla war. Who was still for this? And even after the surrender at Bennett Place, had all talk of guerrilla warfare ceased, or was there still murmuring?
Well, I think Lee's army had become a symbol of Confederate survivability and the independent nation. And with the destruction of Lee's army, its capture, that really, really took much of the enthusiasm or remaining enthusiasm to continue the war out of the Confederate population. It would have been very difficult to sustain a guerrilla operation under those circumstances, I think. And, of course, the Union was prepared to destroy even more than they had already destroyed. And I mean, Sherman's army would have launched even more destructive raids. So it would have been a really difficult situation for the former Confederacy, I think, if they tried to fight a guerrilla war.
John Gus, getting back to Bennett Place here, this little farm in actually Orange County at the time, I think.
That's correct.
Not too far from the rail station, which is one of the reasons it may have been chosen. But what happens, there's an interesting phenomenon here in terms of the history and development of Durham when all of these soldiers camped in Raleigh go back after they smoke something called bright leaf tobacco.
Yes, it's I think you can honestly say throughout military history, three things that are the favorites of any soldier is alcohol, tobacco, and coffee, not necessarily in that order, but as the Union and Confederate troops were moving through the central part of North Carolina, they broke into the warehouses, passed through the farms here in North Carolina, and got a hold of this great bright leaf tobacco. And as the war came to an end, many of these soldiers went home to their homes to everywhere from New York to Ohio to Texas to Arkansas, and gradually, some of them started writing back to the Durham area and requesting some of this great tobacco. And some of the Confederate veterans who had come home, Washington Duke, who had been a Confederate soldier toward the end of the war and ended up being a prisoner of war in Virginia, he actually walked home after the war from the coast of North Carolina and revitalized his farm and got into the tobacco industry and as they say, the rest is history.
The rest is history. What about the Bennetts? What happened to them after this?
Sadly enough, the Bennetts were kind of the typical story of many Southern families, but also a lot of Northern families. They had lost three sons during the course of the war. Mr. Bennett was now into his late 50s, and he had a wife, a daughter, and two grandkids, and they simply could not afford to maintain this farm that they had prior to the war breaking out, and so they started selling off the property. And ultimately, when James Bennett passed away in the late 1800s, Nancy and Eliza, the daughter, they took the grandkids and packed up and moved into what was then becoming the new city of Durham.
Tell us about the Bennett Place site in the immediate aftermath of the war. Once they left, what happened to the site, and then how did it, and also tell us about what's going on there today.
Well, unfortunately, with the family moving out off the property, as far as we know, no one ever moved back into the farm. The farm fell into ruin and disrepair, and then ultimately there was a fire that took place that took the farm to the ground. It was only due to the care and concern of a lot of local citizens, including some Duke family members, who were able to preserve the Bennett property, very much unlike up at Appomattox Courthouse. The National Park Service ultimately took over and was able to preserve Appomattox and turn it into a national park. the Bennett Farm, or Bennett Place as it's become known, was preserved by a group of local citizens. It had no government interaction, and then ultimately in 1960, the Bennett Memorial Commission turned the property over to the state of North Carolina after the farm had been reconstructed and money had been raised to build the infrastructure to turn it into a state historic site.
Tell us about the site today.
Today, Bennett Place has a wonderful visitor center built in 1983, and we are in the process of redesigning our museum. Our exhibits go back to 1983 when the building was first opened to the general public, and so we're excited about that. We've also got some of the Bennett family furniture pieces that have been put on loan to us by Bennett family descendants, the direct descendants of Eliza Bennett, are still here in the North Carolina area, and they've been gracious enough to loan some of the personal effects of the family, which is very exciting because these pieces have not been on the property for well over 140 years.
Joe Glattauer, here we are celebrating the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. How do you think we're looking back on it today at this particular anniversary, and how do you think that has changed over time as people continue to have enormous interest in the Civil War, but that interest and perspective changes certainly with each 50 years, I suppose?
Yeah, one of the big differences between this and the centennial, of course, is resources. We're in the midst of some really difficult financial times, so the sesquicentennial isn't quite as expansive as was the centennial. I think what we're seeing is a much greater recognition of participants other than soldiers in the Civil War. So there's a lot more interest in African Americans, a lot more interest in women, a lot more interest in the home front as well as the battlefield, and the interaction of those two areas. It's awfully difficult for a soldier to fight well when he's concerned about his family at home. And so all these elements are becoming more powerful in our investigations, and I think they're leading to a better and a fuller and richer portrait of what really took place in the American Civil War.
You see different how much interest is there in a place like Bennett site? Is it growing, and what kind of things are people interested in when they come there, John?
Well, certainly the interest is growing thanks to modern technology with the internet. It's enabled us to put a lot more out there for people, and of course we've been able to do a lot more research, understanding the Bennett family more and understanding the troops, the soldiers who are marching through the area. So Bennett Place is definitely growing as far as interest. And a lot of it's attributed to this curiosity I think a lot of people have of this 150th anniversary. Like Joe was saying, a lot more people are getting involved in finding out about their ancestors. There is much more interest in the African-American story and the civilian story. So it's going to be interesting how it all plays out over the next 4 years.
John, Joe, thanks so much for being on the program.
Pleasure, Frank.
Thank you.
Joseph Glattauer is Stevenson Distinguished Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill and author of General Lee's Army, From Victory to Defeat. John Guss is site manager for Bennett Place State Historic Site in Durham. For more information, go to nchistoricsites.org/Bennett. That's the State of Things for today. You know where to find us, stateofthings.org. Find us on Facebook as well. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.